I'm trying to understand what's on page 12, which is what I actually took the time to read during lunch, not getting to page 1, which is at the back. So what's the intended difference between, so recommendations of housing and employment work group, and then it says housing policy recommendations, and then it goes into employment on 12 and 13, and then we have this housing only. Did you just pull the recommendations?
We pull the recommendations directly from the summary document. And so the summary document is just sort of represents the overall work of that work group. And I've always tried to bring back the whole document because I think it's important because it captures various aspects of the work group, not just the recommendations, but the guiding principles, the barriers, the gaps, things that I want, you know, I think that are important to highlight that I heard in those work groups. So overall, though, the recommendations are in the body of the whole report. So if people want to, we can dive into the full report as well. You know, with all the work group recommendations, they are wrapped up into the whole recommendations for the report. We also attach the summaries to the actual report, too, so all that detail is captured from everything we heard in those discussions.
So I guess, so what I thought was missing from here is actually, I guess, instead a guiding principle, but I also thought it was a recommendation relative to housing had to be affordable and accessible, and particularly for individuals with disabilities. If we don't ensure the development of accessible housing stock, we're really doing our community a disservice because then housing isn't available. So it's reflected as a value, but not really as a recommendation that would, I think, then be used to, as we move forward in implementing the recommendation. So I would encourage that become a recommendation.
Okay. We'll take a look at that. I know we have some accessibility in the last bullet in terms of recommendations.
Okay, hold on.
But we can see what we can do to better highlight sort of accessible and affordable housing.
Yeah, that's...
This is Will. I think we're talking about accessible is also that in the community versus purely home design, that home is accessible means that they have access to their community easily versus necessarily the home itself should be designed so it's easy to get in and out of. We want our folks to really be able to access the community easily was a part of it. I think the other one that I was only able to make one of the sub-work groups, but is the how we need to think really beyond our system, that the housing needs in California are huge. I mean, I think it's 200.
Read the New York Times.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's the 200,000 units that haven't been built in the last 20 years. So how do we sort of, you know, incorporate ourselves into other housing projects and just be a piece of that, of other ones who are really going down the same path? It's not sort of become so insular on that becomes a problem. So I think that would really be one. We want to make sure that we're looking at that much broader issue that we're including.
Yeah.
And I would add on that point, you may have seen the announcement that the governor made last night with the speaker in the pro tem about an initiative after the recess that would include a bond and construction guidelines that have been so important to the governor on the issue of housing. So I think it's very timely that the needs of this community get incorporated in the broader housing conversation that's going to be a part of the last part of this legislative session.
That's really exciting.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that too.
And just to your point, Will, again, on the bullet that says department should look at ways to maximize the funding from other programs, including local programs, I think was kind of the intention to try and get at that. We need to be involved in everything at the table at multiple venues, not just our own venue. I know that's something we discussed in depth.
Nothing
there.
About us without it.
It's one of those that that sort of says that if you read between the lines, we're just saying we need to be involved in all housing opportunities, really. I mean, it's like, so it covers that broad range. Because again, we're also looking at being compliant with the settings. We really want to have housing that anybody can buy into, but a piece of it is our guys are there, therefore they're an integrated community as that housing is developed. And I agree with Catherine, really related to the accessibility. It's often the house itself could be accessible, but if it's 20 miles from a bus line, okay, it's not really accessible to the community. So I think that sort of is a weird nuance that we use the term interchangeably.
And I think in some ways it's integration the house is integrated in the community and the house is accessible physically for the individual.
And I think the good news is it seems like we agree on the concept and we're kind of now down to wordsmithing a little mm-hmm. bit. So if there's a way I can be helpful or will just...
Yeah, we'll take a look at it.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Carlos.
Kind of related. An issue that we're going to have to deal with, I think, in affordable housing in the future for persons with developmental disabilities is the density issue. How many people within an apartment complex is acceptable, for lack of a better term? And I don't know at all where it's going to fall within the new waiver rules. So, example, in San Diego, there's a development in process right now where 100% of the occupants of an affordable housing apartment complex would be persons with developmental disabilities. So they would have a choice of their own support living provider, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not making any judgments. I'm just saying that it's more for developers. There's more of an incentive sometimes the higher the percentage of that target population is within a complex. So it's just something we're going to have to think about in the future.
Carlos, is it a private development? I'm just trying to understand. It's private development. It's intended as what's sometimes called an intentional community, or
I don't know what you mean by private development.
So is it like families have come together and they've decided to
there's a similar apartment complex in Orange County.
Uh-huh.
It's privately owned. It does not use regional center funding. It's 100% occupied. This concept, the land was given to a 501c3
uh-huh.
by the city of Poway. So they will, the 501c3 will own it, and they'll lease to individuals. Individuals will arrange through an IPP process for their support living services.
Okay. It must be nice to be in Poway and be given money, given a plot of land. That's, like, fascinating. And I think the one in Orange County, wasn't that the former hotel that somebody bought, like,
yeah.
right on the beach or something?
I think so.
But I think it's something that as we go through this process, we should figure out, because I think there's outstanding questions about is it or isn't it not HCBS eligible, and what does that mean for other kinds of services? And I don't think as a system we can afford to have things not be eligible for federal match, because that's how we're funded at the moment.
Yeah, it's an issue, though.
It's an emerging
yeah.
issue that's worth thinking through, I think, with a lot of smart people that are here. So,
Keisha.
Hello, Keisha Willis at Council on Development Disabilities. Yes, everything needs to be accessible. Like, for example, one guiding principle here is that there needs to be a good information for everyone to understand the options and to navigate the system. I find that this guiding principle is particularly important because, for example, when I try to look for housing, and when everybody tries to look for housing out there, How do we get housing if we can't access the information, if it's not understandable for us? And it's difficult, because the thing is that if we don't understand the information that's coming into us, then how do we get proper accessible housing, you know? So we have to do something about that.
Very true. Thank you. Either comments on the work group summary?
I got Carlos. What'd you do to this mic? On the housing policy recommendations on page 12, or I guess it's on the last page too, I thought we were going to include as one of the recommendations the need for the department or the regional centers to do a needs assessment in terms of what was the housing need among the population of people with developmental disabilities. One of the discussions we had during the work group, by the way, I really want to say how much we appreciate you leading those work groups, because it did drill down on employment and housing and those other issues as well. But one of the things we raised in there, that the state of California doesn't really know what the housing need is for people with developmental disabilities, and it doesn't know what the housing need is now, and it doesn't know necessarily what the housing need will be in 5 years or in 10 years. And then related to that, it doesn't know what the housing stock for that population, for that need is, because it doesn't necessarily correspond that California has X number of housing, generally for the population, but it may not be accessible or appropriate for the person-centered needs of the individuals that we serve. And so I just didn't see that here, because I always thought that, and going back to what you said, Diana, we do have to be really realistic in terms of our resources. And so if we're going to target our resources, we got to target the people who have the highest need for housing, meaning if they're in crisis, and then how do we find crisis? And then, in terms of sustainability, too, is how do you preserve housing stock? So I just want to make sure that somehow that gets included.
Yeah, we can add that in. The department should continue to evaluate housing stock and housing needs. Any other thoughts on the work group document? So, yeah, we can turn to the whole report if people are ready. So, real quick, this sort of followed the pattern of our last full report. We tried to wrap up all the work group recommendations and discussions into sort of a cohesive report, along with all the supporting documentation and meeting notes. Again, it's the new meat of it was probably about 14 pages. Hopefully you guys have had a chance, and I've opened up to any comments and thoughts and edits. And Connie?
Well, unfortunately, I didn't have a chance. I had to take my driver's test yesterday, and then I came home to this. But I passed, so maybe I'll
there
pass this. That was harder than this, trust me. When you get old, you have to take it every few years. Anyway, so page 5 of 14, I just skimmed it really quickly. It's number 12. So it's just the health and safety exemptions, which is, I would put the word timely in there, because that's the key. We know there's they're allowed, but they're not timely. And I don't know if I should raise this. I'm just confused. On page 10 of 14, I'm going to talk about an additional increase of 5% for all supported living. It's the second bullet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't understand that.
You don't understand the second sentence.
Second sentence.
There's a 5% increase in rates.
No, I know.
I think the confusion is the sentence that says this increase does not apply to those services for which rates are determined by DHCS. That makes sense, because they determine ICF, et cetera, rate, nursing rates, et cetera, and those places are not governed by the 5%. And then it goes on to say, or the State Department of Developmental Services. So I think the question is, how is the department interpreting that? And when you make a health and safety exception, are you then determining a rate? And what does that all mean? I think I'm trying to interpret Connie's question to be helpful.
Yeah, my memory of this is it's kind of summarizing what we did in the budget. And John, I don't know if you have a clarification or.
So just the words, or the Department of Developmental Services. Or are usual or customary also makes sense to me, because that's like a Medicaid term, but
missing some words or something.
It feels we'll definitely clarify it.
Yeah.
The cut
so do I
paste,
pass?
The cut and paste didn't quite work.
It was a good question. Isn't that a good question?
Well, yeah, no, that's a helpful edit.
Tell her she got an A.
We seek clarity at all times. Carlos.
So on page 11,
mm-hmm.
The first bullet at the top, and this is with regards to the core staffing formula. the recommendation reads, there should be a minimum qualification for service coordinators, perhaps an MSW, and salaries to retain that level of expertise. I must have been asleep at the wheel or missed that meeting, because I don't remember that, because I would have not agreed with that. Do you want to say something?
Yep.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, Carlos and I were, this caught our eye today. This was an old school methodology, Carlos. Thank you. You ruined the mic.
Because I'm old school?
No, the mic.
Better than just saying you're old, Carlos.
I know.
It ended on old. So we in the old days, you know, there was an ideal for MSWs and LCSWs, and over time, of course, that's not cost effective. And it also doesn't guarantee talent or compassion. We were one of the last regional centers, Orange is now the last regional center to have salaried staff, and there was a requirement for certain levels of expertise and degrees, and we weren't necessarily attracting the talent and the folks who had compassion for the work that's done supporting individuals. And also, we do have a statewide training and information group system that's set up that all regional centers have access to for different training modules, and that's updated quite regularly through a statewide system. So I think that might just be a little too lofty.
Recommend striking perhaps an MSW.
Okay. And I think the perhaps was because I think some folks in the group did raise that as something they were interested in. Others, I think, had concerns. So I think the issue is, you know, minimum qualifications as well as some way to maintain people. I think some folks felt perhaps a master's would be one of those things to look at. But we can go back and see if we can clarify the language in terms of that may be one thing to look at.
Thank you.
Carol.
On page 7, I'm glad to see that Burns and Associates is going to be meeting with the task force and the rates work group, because this system is just very difficult to understand without having people who have really been living it work on that. And the other thing that I wanted to mention or ask, I guess, is when we're going through all of this, we're looking at historical, we're looking at current, we're looking at the future. Are we going to be incorporating all of the HCBS requirements within, or will Burns and Associates be incorporating all of those requirements or the guidelines within their study for the future? So we're not just looking at what we can do now, and then in a few years we're looking at what's going to have to happen again in a few years.
Yeah, that was one of the things, Carol, that it was part of the scope of work that went out. The successful bidder for this contract was going to have to be able to understand the HCBS requirements as they exist, the changes that are occurring, and keep abreast of what's going on with that. So that's something that that'll be incorporated into this whole rate study.
And once we meet with Burns and get sort of a work plan, there'll be more information as for how people can be engaged and participate in that work as well. So, yeah.
I should not have two. Dana Hooper. So I guess my comment relates to the rate study, which will not be presented until March of 2019, just after the expiration of the current administration's term. Seems a little bit convenient. And we're sitting here in 2017 with a rate increase having happened last year. And so I guess my comment is, I think we're going to, sometime between now and 2019, without any further rate adjustments, we're going to be feeling some substantial pain. And so I guess that needs at some point to get back on the table for discussion. The roughly 6% increase was in the normal cost of increases that we've been seeing, good for a couple years, right? 1 year, 3%, 1 year, 3%, doesn't make up for the 8-10 years of no increases. And now we're in the first year past that. We're looking at 1, 2, maybe 3 more. So I think this is something that's going to have to come back onto the table pretty soon. We're, as a provider, losing good people at an accelerated rate, if not because of the economy in general, specifically because the other government-funded organizations and healthcare organizations have been able to raise their wage rates and benefits at a faster clip than we can. And so our turnover has gone from 2, 3, 4% to 18 in the past year. It slowed down a little bit when we implemented the wage increases. So I'd like to see a recommendation that, that there be some look at rates on an interim basis pending completion of the rate study, which still will have the big question of, so what do we do about it? So
I think we tried to capture that in our discussion of the rate study on the three tracks. You know, the recommendation we heard from the group was that, you know, when the department looks at its budget priorities, it should consider those areas of highest need. I think Marty really talked about this, sort of triaging those things that are emergent. The second was that this group would really, you know, give sort of the guiding principles and policy of what a rate system should look like, and then we'd engage in the rate study. So I think to your point about those things that are, you know, problematic ongoing, you know, the department has the guidance in terms of what it does internally for creating its budget, and then there's always the budget process for stakeholders to bring forward, you know, their priorities, and that's an ongoing discussion we're going to have every year. So I think, you know, there's room for those discussions. I think for the purpose of this group, it's sort of a larger, higher level, you know, we want the department to do this work in this way, and that's what I've tried to capture here.
Right. And I do, incidentally, accept that it'll never be enough, right, and that we can't keep up, you know, with the healthcare system or, you know, other government agencies. But I think we have a, you know, responsibility to the people that we're serving here to be their champion in this area, because there's no one else championing the labor force that's caring for them. You know, this is a, this is that, the silent millions of caregivers.
Yeah, that's really valid, Dana. And I think as we build our budget this next year and as we work in the transition in 18 for the first budget of the new governor, we build all that into our budgeting process from all the departments with the various needs that they have, with Medi-Cal, with their rates, and with the hospitals and the, you know, and their rates, and Nancy and her team with the delivery. Our obligation is to assess how the services that are required are delivered and how, where they are. And as you know, leading up to the bill in the special session, that we got some relief. And we've been working on that for 3 or 4 years, you know, getting to that point. So whether or not it shows up as a rate increase from us, it's a perpetual part of the budgeting process, both internally before the governor's budget in January and then through the legislative process. So, you know, I think that they will be on two tracks and we'll all work to get as much valid information as we can and fit it into the resources available.
Will and then Carlos?
No.
Well, I was going to support Carlos on the service coordinators, especially if you're trying to do cultural outreach. Often the promotorio and those folks, they don't have MSW, they may not have a high school degree, but they are the neighborhood connection that would get access to that cultural disparity. So I think you have to look at that. And I think we also, when I go to the housing, I think Dana raised it, our folks, our direct service staff can't afford to live in the areas to support our folks. So housing has to include, I mean, Harbor Village actually started as housing for people who worked at Fairview because they couldn't attract staff. So I think we have to look at different models related to that. And I think that ultimately we don't really have mentioned in this report that just like the case managers, service coordinators are a key link in the regional centers, our direct service professionals on the ground, without them, our folks don't have the opportunity to be here, to be at these meetings, to be employed, to do the things that they want to do. So that really has to sort of be an underlining guiding piece of that. That's really the crux. And we know in the next 10 years, we don't have enough workers for, you know, as Diana would say, her whole system. When you look at the graph, it's growing, and the provider of services is flatlined.
Well, and I almost commented, Carlos, when you made the statement, you and Heather, about the titles. You know, we're seeing this over all of the systems where the hierarchy or the definition of the team is changing dramatically. You know, we brought nearly 5 million people into healthcare coverage, and necessarily healthcare isn't going to be delivered in the same way it was, 10, 15, or even 5 years ago. The changes are dramatic. And as we change the financing systems to more recognition of the outcome, whether it's in bundled payments or goals or block grants or whatever you end up calling it, the idea of being focused on what the outcome is and then letting the systems find their level instead of the super prescriptive formulas of if this, then that, we are being forced to change by the pressure on the system. And I'm seeing it particularly in healthcare delivery with clearly physicians as the captain of the ship, but using a lot of different kinds of people, professional and community-based trained, as you've described. So I think we're in a period without going to the dreaded scope of practice conversation that has elicited the fights in the past. There's a recognition that we're going to find lots of difference, particularly as we look at social determinants of health and other factors that go into what does health look like and how do we get it. So I think it's very timely, and it should be a part of the conversations with the team that's looking at the rate study, not just the rates for paying what we have in the past defined as positions, but focused on what it is that we want as outcomes and how can we perhaps restructure the kinds of people who provide that support and service.
I mean, I would absolutely agree on that, because, I mean, right now our quality measure in our system is often what's the staff-to-client ratio.
Yeah.
And I clearly know of folks who can have 12 people and do phenomenal at it, and some people one-on-one couldn't do a good job. So we do have to come to a better way to sort of analyze and what are we paying for. So I think it is something we really do have to take a look at. And I think we also then have to encourage the legislature as they do things and provide us new funds. Paid internship is great. But they also had a list of things that they wanted to know about, which is also good. But then everybody starts to add on the layers of bureaucracy, which makes that to get a paid internship, my staff are like, that's 20 hours of work that we don't get paid for. And then we'll bill, it'll take us 2 or 3 hours every month to bill for that. It's a great opportunity. We got people who just got hired full-time jobs because of it.
But you just have to get a health and safety waiver.
Yeah, I mean, but the weight of having to meet all the requirements. So I think when we look on the employment side, and we talk about flexibility, but I think our challenge has always been employment is employers want someone when they want someone and not when we say, well, you know, wait a sec, it'll take us 90 days to get them open with Department of Rehab and then go, oh, wait a minute, the case manager has to agree. We get ourselves into some really funny boats of saying, here's the outcome we want, but we then put up so many barriers, it's like, let's make it work. So, I mean, I think whatever we can do that sort of provides relief in that, and we'll always sort of have that lens on, it's like, okay, what do we really need to get and what are we demonstrating? Health and safety is clearly always one of what are the outcomes we're really shooting for.
Carlos?
So there's a service provider who, he's our service provider representative on our board of directors, and the boards are required to approve contracts over $250,000. And as we bring the CPP contracts for the development, he brought up a really interesting point that kind of altered my Am I looking at the way I'm looking at reality today? So he had a comparison of the funding for the CPP service of a particular residential home versus his home, which is very similar, and there's a huge gap, obviously. There's a huge gap in the funding for those two models. So as development centers close, and hopefully we use, we'll maybe call it something different, but the CPP money differently, looking at, he said, I don't have any animosity, nothing against that service provider because they're getting what they need. That's the reality there, and we're not. So as we start to develop or enhance community resources, I think that's our goal, is to bring that equity to the reality of what service providers need. That's it.
Connie.
So one of the reasons, you know, a lot of us are here is because we want to bring our experience. And I want to thank you for this process because I feel I've been taken seriously and that my input, I feel a lot of our input has been really valued. And it comes forward with words. So I just want to wordsmith on page 11 of 14. One of the things that is one of the hardest things to do, seems like everything's hard, is quality assurance. I mean, how do you really measure someone's happy? And part of that I've talked about at some of these meetings is the fear of, let's say, a provider feeling if he was really honest about some of his challenges, he would get dinged. Or a consumer or a family thinking, if I really say what I'm worried about, I'm going to lose this service. So when we do quality assurance, it's the second from the last bullet on before the recommendations for the safety net. I'd love to say simply, in fact, we did this at the DD Council on our platform, measure what matters. And I just like it because it makes sense. Basically, measure what matters to the consumer, you know, and or, you know, the family. But sometimes we're measuring stuff that doesn't matter, and it's simple and it resonates with me. And then the other thing is, the other point I want to make is employment. Page 13 of 14, you talk about transition from, like, let's say, a workshop, but what is really key, and I've been on the Employment First Committee, I've been on a lot of these committees, is comprehensive transition planning throughout somebody's life so that even when somebody's really little, they can start to talk about what do you want to be when you grow up, you know, and what would that look like? And that's why person-centered planning is so good, because you talk about your dreams and it can lead to some kind of job that you wouldn't even, nobody would have even thought of. So, and that's a key problem because it costs money in terms of education and regional centers. So those were my 2 points. I didn't have a chance to absorb it all.
Yeah, so. And if there's other thoughts you have, Connie, you can send them to me.
Okay, afterwards.
Thanks. As anyone can. Any other thoughts, comments, observations, edits?
I'll do it as well. I would agree with Connie. I think the one we don't have in here is actually quality improvement. Quality assurance is always looking backwards. Quality improvement is how we do it better tomorrow. And I think that somehow in here we should really be putting something that says, yes, we didn't do as best we could today, but tomorrow we could do it differently and do it better. I think that's, you know, we definitely agree with that. And I think I agree with it. Measuring what matters is we have to identify what are those key things that we want and then figure out how to attract and do that. And I think that's one of the challenges we've always had in the system is it's very complex. People's needs are very individualized, and how do we sort of identify some key things that really say, are people making the choices and getting to do the activities they want to do, and are they doing it in settings that they want to be in? I mean, it's whatever that looks like, and go from there.
Okay. Thank you, Will. Keisha.
Mike.
Got it.
Keisha, Weatherstate Catholic Day, Bemidji Disabilities. Person-centered planning is so important because a lot of regional centers do individualized planning, which means basically they say, okay, we are going to give you what you need, what you need, but they don't go around the person and look what the person wants, what they actually need. And that's really hard because when I was a consumer advocate at the Westside Regional Center, I went to consumers coming to me and saying, look, my IPP is my, the regional center saying, look, we could do you these services, but that's not what I want. Like, you could go into the state program, but I don't want, these consumers are saying, I don't want to go into the state program. I want to work. I want to be employed. And so we have to change that. We have to get regional centers and other regional centers to go into personal center planning and stuff like that. Thank you.
Thank you, Keisha. Yeah, sure, Fredo.
Oh, yeah. Take care of both of you guys.
Regions now will help you with all the key programs. Programs to help you get a job, and they will support you for that. And if you need a job, for example, if Regional Center says, you want this, you got it, we have to talk to you, SC, and you, the program director.
Rando. Any other comments on the overall document? All right, so it's probably a good time to break for public comment right now for round two. Jim?
Hi. I'd like to thank the members of the group for taking the time necessary to go through the details, the overwhelming details over a period of years to come up with a document that I can take back to my community and, you know, go over and help people understand and continue to work with the department to make impact as well. I wanted to mention one thing. My name is Shella Dumong. I'm from Santa Barbara, and I'm the director of a person-centered housing company. I'm nervous. Excuse the voice shake. I was taking a look at some of the housing recommendations, and one of the things that I was concerned was missing is the issue of rent subsidies. You know, if rent is $1,000 and someone's Social Security grant is $895, how is it that people pay the rent? So I don't think that housing recommendations can be complete if there isn't a mention of how affordable housing is achieved for people. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Casey Dillard, and I am the Advocacy and Project Development Manager at Choices Person-Centered Services, located here in Sacramento, and I also work closely with Marty Amoto at CDCAN. I first want to thank the department and the members of the task force for holding this meeting and for all of the work that you do. I just quickly wanted to mention an art exhibit that I've helped organize that's currently being displayed at the California Museum just up the street on 10th and O. the title of the exhibit is Art and Advocacy to be Developmentally Disabled. And this exhibit represents the perspectives and advocacy of artists with developmental disabilities from across California. Some of the pieces provide a glimpse into the artists' individual struggles or their struggles within their own community, including communities of color. Through their art pieces, some of the artists describe their feelings of despair, fear, isolation, and injustice. While other artists speak to their own hopes, dreams, and desires, including love and equality, others reveal new perspectives on familiar places, people, or objects. This is art that is authentic and compelling that in turn is advocacy and can help bring about awareness and change and solutions. So I'm just here to encourage all of you to go check out the exhibit. It's really a compelling and inspirational thing for everyone to see. And I brought with me some flyers that offer a discount to for admissions for that exhibit. And if you have any other questions, I'll be here till the end of the meeting, so feel free to come up and ask me. Thank you.
I am so glad that you brought that up because Mark
party invited me to sort of cut the ribbon on the opening of that exhibit a few weeks ago, and I was so deeply moved. The art is amazing, and all of the artists were there, and they were recognized, and it is a tremendous exhibit, and it's encouraged so many people to go by and see it. It's on O Street between 10th and 11th. And one of the pieces was dedicated to Governor Brown, and it sort of chokes me up. Next to each exhibit is a description of the artist's perspective on the art and how or why they did it. And this artist's description of Governor Brown's leadership was so moving. I've got photographs I can show you of several of the pieces, but I photographed that one in such a way that you could kind of enlarge it and read it and send it to Jerry and Ann, and they were both so touched and impressed with it. And Ann said that the governor's wife said that she was going to make a point of getting over to see the exhibit while they were there. And the first piece when I walked in was just one of labels. It just is so incredibly powerful. I can't say enough about this exhibit and how wonderful it is and how you should all see it. So thank you, Marty. And I didn't catch your, Casey. Thank you so much. It's a great, great exhibit. Other public comments?
Thank you. My name is Michelle Hyde. I'm from the California Consortium for Behavior Analysis. First, I want to say thanks for hiring one of ours at the CBA at the department. I'm super excited about that. I have more of a question, not a comment, but I know that you said about the HCBS funding that some framework was going to be provided for future proposals. How was the disparity funding decided? How was that HCBS money decide who, you know, what was the framework for deciding which proposals got accepted and which ones didn't?
So the disparity funding, $11 million, so both for both the $11 million and the $15 million on the HCBS with assisting providers in taking the steps towards compliance with the new federal rule, each one had guidelines, separate guidelines. So with the HCBS, we had the concept papers that came to the department, and as Jim had shared, you know, there was a 900 concept papers that helped inform us as to, you know, where folks were in their assessment process. And so the team at the department, in reviewing the concept papers, took a look at not necessarily which ones were the most complete, but those that tied to how were the assessments tying to the needs of being able to go into compliance. By whittling that down, the number of proposals really did go way down to, I think, I don't remember the total number when it came to the staff reviewing it. That the lens that they used at that point then was to make sure it was representative throughout the state, to make sure there's a representation of awards going to different service types. So making sure there's a cross-reference to making sure that there's those elements to it. On the disparity, when the regional center submitted their proposals to the department, again, we took a look at it not only based on what the needs were within the community that were identified with the community meetings that each regional center had and how the proposal supported based on the stakeholder input from the local meetings and how those two tied together. The other piece was to make sure that as we then approved the funding, that we looked at a very cross-section, making sure that across the state that we're looking at making sure that every regional center in their community had funds available to be able to advance their efforts to address inequity in spending and how that, again, mirrored. And we took a look at how many regional centers had the Pormadora model, some of the models that stakeholders had shared that were very positive experiences that were meaningful to their community. So those were the priorities. As Jim had shared, and then also Brian on the disparity, as the guidelines come out, because certainly with the $11 million on the disparity funding this year, it's changing in the sense with the funding is going to be a grant,
We're going to be working on guidelines going to the regional centers and will be available for community-based organizations going forward to also apply for the funding. So we're going to be able to see a different approach. And again, it still has to tie within each of the local communities, making sure that connection is there and consistent with what is being reported based on disparity data locally, but also stakeholder input. And then with the $15 million, the guidelines, as Jim was sharing, will be also coming out and making sure that we're consistent in helping providers comply. So there's a lot of factors and variables that go in, but it's not done without a number of things that we need to take a look at. Okay, thank you.
See no other public.
ABC. All right. I continue to think that it's pretty cool that the Secretary of the Health and Human Services Agency is sitting with us today, listening to us, the concerns. Have worked at the department. I remember receiving input and how difficult it could be to hear things you don't want to hear, and sometimes how difficult it could be to implement the recommendations. So I applaud you, Secretary Dooley. Thank you.
Me to do a little bit of air traffic control at the same time, but I have learned so much from all of you and have really appreciated it. I know you know there are a lot of demands on my time, and I choose where I go because I want to get something out of it as well, and you all nourish and feed me, so I really appreciate it. Thanks to you all. Keisha, you can have the last word today.
Well, thank you, Secretary Dooley. I just want to say that us task force members, we really appreciate you, Secretary Dooley, and the department for all the great work that you do. We greatly, greatly appreciate it because we know that with these difficult times, especially stuff in Washington and stuff like that, we greatly appreciate the great lines that you have to do in the tight rope that you have to do to do your work. And as task force members, we really appreciate you, Secretary Dooley, and the department for all the great work that you do.
So we are all in this together. Thank you. Go safely wherever you're headed, and we'll see you next time. Thanks. Perfect. Yes. I didn't think we were there for a while.